Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
A negative trade balance. Some countries with a big deficit seem to be doing okay, like America, even the UK to an extent, whereas others, like Japan, have a trade surplus and an economy that's on a road to nowhere. So how important is a trade balance that is positive for the overall good of an economy? And what about jobs? If you import lots, does that mean you're doing away with local jobs? That was obviously one of the concerns of Donald Trump. Too many jobs going to China. Today, can you really survive with a negative trade balance? This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Professor Steve Keen. I'm Phil Dobby. Welcome along. Now, obviously, not everyone can have a positive trade balance. If some are positive, others have to have trade deficits because it is a zero-sum game. But does that mean countries with a trade deficit don't fare as well? Well, not really. I mean, the US trade deficit hit $81 billion in September this year. It's the worst ever. Is that a problem for the US? Well, maybe it is a little bit, but they've been in a trade deficit for a long time and seem to be doing pretty well. And Steve will tell us, I'm sure, that that is because they are the reserve currency for the world. But there are other countries as well with their trade deficits that aren't doing so badly. And of course, GDP is calculated on government and public spending, so consumption by the by consumers and businesses, plus business investment in capital goods and the net trade balance, all added together. So a deficit, a trade deficit, does pull your GDP figure down. But if your economy is healthy otherwise, then Steve, you can still have a strong GDP even if you have that that trade deficit, can't you?
You can, but I think it ends up being something which is quite conditional. And I mean, because if you're coming from the Australian background, of course, Australia was running trade deficits for decades before it's run some recent trade surpluses, but normally it's been in a trade deficit situation. And the rationale for that you get to justify why it has this long-running trade deficit from the point of view of mainstream economists was, oh, well, this must be because we're investing more than the rest of the world. You know, our savings aren't enough to finance what we're doing, so we're borrowing from overseas as well. And this will ultimately mean we turn around having a trade surplus. Now, we are having a bit of it. Australia is having a bit of a trade surplus in current years, occasionally up and down, but a bit of a surplus. But the whole explanation that gives is that if you're running a trade deficit, it's because you're importing more capital goods than you're exporting, and therefore you're going to build up your productive capacity, and in the future you'll flip over. It's a nice little argument, which when you look at the empirical data just doesn't make sense, because there are many countries which have had sustained deficits and haven't turned them around and end up having long-running collapses. The Argentina and the Turkey cases come to mind at the moment. So I think it's, to me, there's a lot of woolly thinking about trade deficits and trade surpluses, and the woolly thinking isn't just restricted to neoclassical thought. It also turns up on some of the progressive thought as well,
which we'll get to. But I mean, is it a case that you could have you could bumble along with a narrow trade deficit and you'd get by? It's only when it gets out of control. So I mean, Australia spent, you know, most of the last 50 years in deficit, didn't it? It's only the last 5 years. And then it's been coal and iron ore prices, really, which have given it a surplus. But it was, it was getting up to 4% of GDP before the pandemic in terms of its surplus. But before that, you know, go back a few years and, yeah, it was, in deficit, but had a high GDP growth rate. I mean, you know, quite a bit since 2000. I mean, it touched 5%, the GDP growth rate on some occasions, even though the country was in a trade deficit.
Yeah, there's no necessity that negative ones are going to give you a negative on the other. But my perspective, and this puts me at odds with both neoclassicals and modern monetary theory, is that if you're running a trade deficit, you're importing more than you're exporting, and that is draining. It will end up being a drain on your local monetary production. You're effectively providing money for other countries to do their own development. It's not a case that Japan is using Australian dollars to invest in producing new vehicles, but that Japan, because we're running a deficit in terms at the individual level, if you sum up all the Australian individuals, all the Australian companies, they're importing more than they're exporting. What we are doing is effectively enabling Japan to create more yen to invest in its own productive capacity. So in this case, I find myself strongly siding with what Keynes hoped to achieve at Bretton Woods and, of course, failed because he was overruled by the Americans, which was a regime which put strict limits on how large not just trade surpluses, but trade deficits, but also trade surpluses could get, and put controls on both deficit and surplus countries, that if you were running a deficit, you would ultimately be forced to devalue your currency against the international currency, which was going to be the bankor. But if you ran a surplus, you were taxed on the surplus, and the tax was used to help develop, in particular, third world countries that we would expect to run a trade deficit, because if they're going to industrialize, they first of all have to import investment goods from the first world before they can manufacture their own. So that was the idea, and Keynes's target, I think, was something like no more than a 2% of GDP surplus or deficit. But if you looked around the world these days, you'd be hard pressed to find countries within the -2 to +2 range. Most of them either got, more than 2% deficit or more than a 2% surplus.
Yeah.
And my feeling is a major reason why we have such a unbalanced international economic system.
Well, I mean, it's bad news, isn't it, for developing economies where they've got a high demand. If you want to grow, for example, you've got to buy capital equipment from overseas, and to do that, you've got to you've got to spend money in a foreign currency, which obviously devalues your own currency if you're sending a lot of that overseas and converting it. But for developed economies, so say the UK buys lots of cars from Japan. So Japan all of a sudden has a lot of British pounds. It's got to do something with that money. So, doesn't it all come back and create jobs back in Britain?
No, not well. This
or investment. You get into question about foreign investment as well. But I mean,
what you've got is Britain is buying Japanese cars with British pounds.
Yeah,
and there's many ways that can be worked through the mechanics. But the simplest way to think about it is that British consumers give a Japanese company British pounds, which means that the Japanese company has to convert those. If it's going to remit the profits to Japan, then it has to convert those pounds into yen. And I've had this discussion with Warren Mosler at one stage some years ago now, that it doesn't matter how this is done, it all goes through the international markets and so on. But at the end of the day, the result of British buyers of Japanese cars is that British bank accounts go down in pounds and Japanese bank accounts go up in yen, you can imagine that the pounds that are paid to the Japanese company end up being submitted to the Central Bank of Japan as money to be converted into yen by the company, and the Japanese Central Bank then has additional pounds as part of its foreign currency reserve, while the Japanese company has additional yen, which it can then use to further invest on developing Japanese cars.
So you're saying the net result is if we buy lots of Japanese cars, then Japanese banks will have lots of pounds in reserve, which presumably
not the Japanese banks. The reserves are predominantly going to be held by the central bank. The private banks themselves will have foreign currency as part of their overall allocation of assets, but.
So more pounds sitting overseas in central banks is the net result
if you've got. Yeah.
So probably you say, well, okay, we need that. That means we're running short of money, cash locally. So we've got our own currency. So we will just expand our money supply to compensate. But all of that.
Well, that's what I think is the effect. Yeah.
All of that devalues the pound, doesn't it? So theoretically, I know theory and reality are a long way apart in economics, but in theory. carry.
Indeed.
If the pound gets cheaper because we are buying a lot in, and all that money is sitting overseas and devalues because there's so much of it sitting overseas, then that should make it becomes cheaper. It makes us cheaper for our export. So we should become more of an export economy.
Yeah, but the trouble is, to export, you've got to invest.
Yeah.
And this is the point that I think that conventional economics and parts of modern monetary theory as well just don't do justice to, because to invest requires money. Now, if you were following the sort of export-oriented industrialization program that countries like Japan and Korea and China have done over the last 40 or 50 years, what they're doing, saying is, we're going to export much more than we import if we can manage, sell. Initially, it was cheap Japanese cars and cheap goods. And then what we would do with that money is the extra money we're making from overseas sales, we reinvest in developing our technology. And over time, we produce more and more sophisticated cars and then expand and become dominant on the car market. And that is precisely what Japan did. I can remember as a school kid, and I'm talking back at the age of about six, with mates in the class, talking over that with six-year-olds discussing, as they tend to do, how good various cars are, and always rubbishing the Japanese and saying how good the Holden and the Ford were. Mm.
How misinformed were you? Yeah, exactly.
Well, actually, at the age of six, I wasn't too far off the mark, because you had these teeny little things like the Datsun 1000, for example. And then you said, who'd buy them? Well, somebody who wanted a cheap car and couldn't afford an expensive American-designed, Australian-manufactured car. And over time, because there was that market segment that the rest of the global car manufacturing system was ignoring, they got the sales, they got the revenue, and the whole pressure was to produce better and better quality cars. And now, of course, Japan is the country, it's losing out in the electric car race to some extent, but it became the country with a reputation for quality cars, not junk.
Yeah.
And that was because the export surplus generated revenues that could be used to invest and drive their manufacturing capabilities up.
So what's worse in your view then? A country that's got a high trade deficit, or a country that's got a trade surplus, but it's the result of a lot of foreign direct investment? Because that can often disguise the figure. So we know Japan, for example, is busy spending money in many parts of the world, creating jobs, perhaps, certainly creating products which are counted as exports, although not necessarily contributing much to jobs.
This is one directly contradicting what I see people in MMT arguing. I think that if you're looking at your own self-interest, then I think the best situation for a country is a trade surplus.
Irrespective
reasons.
Of where the money comes from to pay for the investment in those companies or the ownership of those companies.
I mean, if you're doing it by domestic sales, then you're getting the money directly for a domestic corporation. So it travels back to something that the post-Keynesian economic literature is quite strong on, and I wish this turned up more in how modern monetary theory thought about international trade, is that when you look at the way in which goods are manufactured, corporations face declining marginal cost and have excess capacity. This is the rule throughout the world, that manufacturing is done in factories that are designed by engineers to be most efficient at their at full capacity. Because you're competing against other firms, you have excess capacity, which means with the excess capacity, you can take advantage of any mistakes your competitors make. And you're also able to handle growth in the economy where, the economy gets larger than you expect and demand grows. You have the capacity to sell into that directly rather than having to build new factories before you can sell into it if you're working at full capacity. So all these corporations are operating with excess capacity. You've got excess capacity and you can't make use of that excess capacity on the domestic market, then you try the export market.
Mm.
And this is a lot, I think, of what was the reason for the success of Japan's industrialization. They were selling a lot of products to domestic buyers. I mean, if you look at Japan's industry, it began with, I think it was Mr. Honda, who was the first one to strap a petrol motor, a four-stroke motor, onto a bicycle. And that's all that, you know, in the aftermath of the Second World War, that's all the Japanese consumers could afford. And at the same time started developing, and you know, you had Toyota and the other companies coming in as well, developing cars for a very small luxury market domestically. But that was also exactly the same cars could be sold into a very large, cheap car market in the rest of the world.
Mm.
And this meant that they were using more of their capacity than they could have used if they just stuck with selling to the domestic market. And for this reason, if you have a country which in general is running a trade surplus with its manufacturing sector, then it's going to have a higher level of capacity utilization of its factories, and as a result of that, lower costs per unit, because since you have such high fixed costs,
yeah,
and your marginal costs are constant or falling, the higher the output you do, the lower your unit costs and the higher your profit.
Yeah, all economies of scale. Reason, yeah.
So, yeah. But no, not economies of scale, not economies of utilization.
Mm.
This is one mistake we make, because economies of scale mean if you have a blast furnace which is, you know, 1 meter cubed, then you've got 6 square meters of metal to make it, and it can make one cubic meter.
No. So it's capacity utilization, maximizing
capacity utilization.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you target export sales, then you have a higher level of capacity utilization. You benefit from that with lower unit costs, and then you can invest as well. So it's a whole series of positive feedbacks.
Right, but that's if it's your company in your company in your country. But if you've got,
yeah,
say, Toyota said, right, we are going to build 5 new car plants in the UK, and that sort of crowds out the opportunity for Dobby cars, which were just about to break into the market.
Oh, damn!
I know, yeah. And everyone's buying a Toyota because there's lots of them around. Plus, Toyota are exporting a lot to Europe. Then that foreign direct investment is helping. You know, it may be creating jobs locally, but is the country really benefiting from having foreign money coming in, foreign money going back out? You know, the profits being repatriated back to Japan.
I think that's a weakness. And this was the Australian economy was the classic for that. At one stage, they had 5 car manufacturers there, all 100% foreign owned. If you look at, you know, Ricardo's theory of comparative advantage and the modern variants of it as well, they all assume that the capital and the incomes to capital and labour remain in the countries in which the products are sold.
Yeah.
Because if you don't have that, they can't make their welfare claims. But, you know, you can't say welfare of the UK is going to increase if the profits end up going back to Japan. So I think it's erroneous to rely upon foreign direct investment in that sense.
Which GDP GDP doesn't pick that up. That's why we look at gross national income, isn't it? Because GDP, that is basically GDP plus the money flowing in and out of the economy. So it accounts for payments going out to foreign companies. So Ireland, for example, gave up really on GDP because it was becoming so distorted, because there's a country where there's so much money coming in and going out again. Money laundering. Literally, you know, without necessarily anything being produced, you know, so the likes of Amazon and so forth.
And that's, you know, why I think the policies, again, that the Asian countries have followed, that predominantly they've done it with their own local manufacturers.
Mm.
They've had, you just didn't see them doing the sorts of, China is producing, I don't actually know the name of any of the Chinese car companies, okay? They haven't got to the stage where they've penetrated the mindset in the same way that the Japanese cars did. But the scale of Chinese car manufacturing is enormous. And it's all Chinese companies that are doing it. I think we now have Tesla going in there. And that is one of the few reasons that I can accept a foreign direct investment to make your vehicles rather than doing it yourselves, because there is so much technology that is proprietary to Tesla that nobody else has, that, you know, it's just not possible to compete with them in that market. And so if you're going to have your people who are going to be buying their cars from overseas, you might as well get them to buy it locally, and at least the wages are being paid to local workers rather than ones overseas. So you retain some of the cash flow that otherwise would be going out in purchasing imports.
So in the what happened in the US? Because in the early 70s, the US didn't have a trade deficit, or if it did, it was very small. It was around 2005. It got down to minus 5.5% of GDP. It's bounced back, but that is a big figure, isn't it? It's also misleading when you quote it as a percentage of GDP, because you're quoting a ratio against something that actually includes the number that you're quoting. So so it actually brings the number down even more, doesn't it? But why that turn from being, you know, a little or no trade deficit to all of a sudden now, where we just assume that America has a trade deficit, and you know, even though Donald Trump tried to fix it, it looks unfixable, doesn't it?
Well, this is the point that Yiannis Varoufakis makes very well in the Global Minotaur, and that is that once America insisted on being the reserve currency of the planet, then effectively the fate of its manufacturing sector was sealed, because there was going to be demand for American dollars over and above the demand for American goods, and consequently, you know, even back in the days of the fixed exchange rate, that was pressure for America to devalue. Once you had the floating exchange rates, then people would be buying American dollars for the sake of having American dollars, which would drive up the exchange rate, making American dollars more expensive and make the manufacturing sector uncompetitive. So over time, it's a curse to be the reserve currency for a planet. And this is why I find it quite amusing looking at back at Harry Dexter White in the Bretton Woods agreements, overruling Keynes and saying, no, we're not going to create an artificial currency. We want the American dollar to be the reserve currency of the planet, which was, in American terms, we want to blow one of our feet off because it hobbled. It made the American financial sector absolutely essential to the global economy, and certainly that side of America has done very well, thanks very much. But the manufacturing sector has suffered because its dollar is overvalued, because it is the international reserve currency.
So what about, I mean, Donald Trump's point was as well that, you know, that all these foreign companies producing stuff which America was buying now rather than producing was taking away American jobs. But, you know, I've read stuff saying actually this argument about jobs going overseas is difficult to quantify. So, for example, if Japan makes cars and exports them to America, the American has to find a job to pay for that car. If nobody has a job, nobody can afford the cars, therefore the sale's not made. So there has to be a job that's replaced the job that's been taken away, otherwise people can't buy anything.
Well, you have a declining economy, which is what America's had. Paul Krugman was a major one to argue that, you know, you're just dismissing the whole idea that jobs were exported effectively by the relocation of production from American corporations to Asia. He's finally, I've seen just recently, conceded, yes, okay, I was wrong. There has been a reduction in American employment, and obviously a reduction in American manufacturing capability by the relocation of production by transnationals to third world countries. And in that sense, China, Korea, Japan in particular, have all industrialized on the basis of an American policy that was, you know, asserting American power, but actually hobbling America in its chance to maintain its industrial lead over time.
Your point about imports, that if you don't import lots of stuff and you produce it locally, then you're going to develop the scale at which you can produce it far more effectively, and then you'll have more surplus to export overseas. Mm. And you gave the example of Japan for that. I mean, there's another argument, isn't there? Say if you import a lot, then, for example, you lower your trade barriers, you're going to improve the performance of your domestic producers. You know, they're going to find out what is it that they're doing overseas that we could do better. And so you create a more efficient local industry, which over time would mean that you would be able to, particularly if your currency is losing value in the meantime because of all those imports, then you'd develop an export industry over time. It might take a long time, mind you. We might all be dead by then.
Yeah, maybe like, you know, one or two millennia. I mean, this is where I like the work of Danny Roddick in particular. And a few other empirically oriented trade researchers, they've found that the countries that protected their industries and put their industries under pressure to compete with imports were the ones that developed over time. So, and also Michael Hudson's own, his PhD thesis was called America's Protectionist Takeoff. So if you take a look back at the 1800s, and see what even part of the 1700s, I think, what led to the development of American industrial capability were tariffs that prevented European and particularly British imports. And that meant that America had to develop its own iron and steel industry, which it duly did. And that gave it a technological lead over the Europeans. So ultimately they could say, let's have free trade. And now we've got the technologically more advanced industry. So, it's not the case that you should, you know, protection all the time is superior. What ends up happening is that if you grab the trade surplus for yourself, invest that and push your industrial level forward, then at some point you're big enough and strong enough to say, let's have free trade with the rest of the world and drive the trade barriers down. Same thing applied to the UK. When trade, in the mercantilist period, before the Scottish industry developed not just the steam engine, but also the spinning jenny and all the technological revolutions of the early industrial revolution. Both Indian and Chinese textiles were much cheaper and much better quality than the British. And the British then prevented India, which of course they dominated through the East India Company, prevented Indian manufacturing selling clothing to the UK. But then over that 30-year period with dramatic industrialization, England was able to produce not the same quality, obviously, but far cheaper textiles. Mm. And they then demanded free trade so they could export to India. And that was part of what led to the deindustrialization of India. Because when this was all happening, the population breakup in India was 70% urban and 30% rural. And through the this whole process of forcing India to open up to exports from the UK, the ratio was reversed. You had massive famines, huge death. So
the English are bastards, aren't they? Do you imagine?
Yeah, the Scottish are okay, but the English are bastards, yeah.
So what about this crazy idea of Bill Mitchell, the modern monetary theorist, that exports are bad, imports are good? I mean, his argument is, exports mean that we have to give something real to foreigners that we could use ourselves, and that is obviously an opportunity cost, he says. Imports, I find this very hard to fathom, imports represent foreigners giving us something real that they could use themselves, but we benefit from having, so the opportunity cost lost is all theirs. I mean,
is that a direct quote?
Yeah. That sounds to me like modern monetary theory ignores money, because if I export, I get paid. It gives me a foreign currency, which I can then use to buy other stuff, you know, stuff that I actually want rather than stuff that I might be making too much of.
Yeah, and this is one of my main gripes about this, because when you look at where modern monetary theory came from, it was Warren Mosler was the originator of the concept. Stephanie Kelton, when she was Stephanie Bell, acknowledged this, that Warren turned up and was saying to, you know, trying to find some economist who would accept his proposition that a government doesn't tax to spend, it spends to tax. And she said her initial reaction, we're all very skeptical about it, we didn't accept it. And then we checked the logic and found that he was right. And then, of course, I have complete agreement with that particular side of modern monetary theory. But Warren also came up with the line that exports are a cost and imports are a benefit.
Why does he even go there? Well, I mean, it just because I think what happens
partly because I'm not going to dive into trying to work out the psychology, his psychology here. But what I think was going on was that he was also running at various times running for the president of American presidential election, and partly he was saying you don't need to worry about the trade deficit now. And then the argument would trade deficit is actually good because exports are a cost and imports are a benefit. Now, that, you know, that can be used by the reserve currency country, which obviously America is. It can't be used as an argument anywhere else. I think it's a false argument in either situation.
Yeah. Well, if you produce a lot of something and you've got no market for it domestically because everyone's already got one.
It's not an opportunity cost. This is the point. I mean, that's why I wanted to check that it was a direct quote from Bill. Mm. Because what on earth is the concept of opportunity cost doing turning up in a post-Keynesian argument? because opportunity cost is a straight neoclassical concept. And this is one of the things that most people, let's have a talk about opportunity cost one day. I think we have done once in the past.
Yeah, we have a couple of times.
Okay.
We've done 250 episodes. We've talked about everything at least twice, Steve.
Okay. The opportunity cost argument says that if you do one thing, you can't do another. Mm. Therefore, the cost of doing something is what you can't do instead.
Yeah.
And that is something which is very sensible at the individual level. So there's only, 24 hours in a day. If you sleep for 12, you can only be awake for 12. If you sleep for 8, you can be awake for 16. It makes absolute sense at the individual level. But at the economy level, the only way it makes sense is if you have 100% capacity utilization of your resources. If you have full employment, not just of labor, but of machinery as well. And that is not the case. We know MMT is all a large part of it is trying to achieve full employment of labor. But again, looking at the empirical data, even if you achieved full employment of labor, and I think you can regard the 60s, the early 60s to the early 70s as a period of full employment in America, even when you have unemployment at very, very low levels then, you still have capacity utilization of below 90%. There was at least 10% spare capacity because in a capitalist economy, it is, in particularly a growing capitalist economy, it's sensible to have excess capacity, both because when you invest, you have to build for a factory for sales for the next 10 or 15 years, not today's sales. So you build it big enough for its growth intention. And then secondly, with excess capacity, you can compete with your competitors. If they slip up, you can fill up the hole they leave in the market. So the opportunity cost makes no sense as a macroeconomic concept, and yet it's being used there to justify an argument for modern monetary group, the people who proposed modern monetary theory.
I think it's a direct question. But anyway, the gist of his point is that, exports are bad and imports are good. But if you go back to Adam Smith's argument, and maybe here's where an area of conventional economics that would be hard to argue against. The buyer is giving up what he values less to buy something that he values more. So if I export what I don't value and I buy, but someone else values more, then you both win. I buy something that's not valued a great deal overseas. Maybe the manufacturers of iPhones don't value it very much because they don't get very good broadband connections
reception
there. And we value it a great deal. So, that seems like unarguable logic, unless perhaps you're Bill Mitchell, because it goes against everything he's saying.
I think it's contradictory, and this is what it irritates me that it's still part of it. If you have to drag in a neoclassical concept like opportunity cost to justify an argument, in my opinion, you've already lost the argument. It does not apply at the macro level. And rather than exports being a cost because, oh dear, we could have used that Mercedes-Benz locally, exports enable you to use excess capacity, which would otherwise be unused, and you therefore have higher costs and higher cost per unit and lower profit. It's eminently sensible that in that sense, exports are a gain in monetary terms because you get monetary revenue you wouldn't otherwise get, and also in physical terms because since you're using a higher proportion of your unutilized capacity, you have lower costs per unit than your rivals do.
Yeah.
So it is just a wrong-headed piece of thinking, and I would just wish somebody would say, look, Warren, that's one slogan we disagree with. Throw it away. Sorry.
Look, next time we're doing a podcast called Not All Contrarians Are the Same, so we'll no doubt revisit monetary theory. Look, is there, just finishing off today then, is there an optimum level, do you believe? I mean, you talked about how Keynes was talking about the bancor, so you'd have plus or minus by a certain percentage. Is there an optimum level where trade surplus or a deficit doesn't really matter? Like, is it, 4 or 5%?
I wouldn't go 4 or 5. I'd go in the sort of minus 2 to plus 2 range. And you also have countries which are never going to be able to, to reach a balanced trade because they're too small without enough, tourism features to make up for it for a tourism trade. So there are some countries which are going to be chronically stuck with trade deficits.
And how do you fix that? Without going down the road of the bancor, all those developing countries that are indebted to the West to buy stuff that they need to try and get themselves out of the situation, which they never do. I mean, how do you fix that issue?
Well, that was part of the design of the Bancor. Was the yeah. Bancor was effectively an international trade system as well as a system for regulating. Was an international aid as well as international trade, and you know, I think you know, Keynes thought it through very, very well, and that's what we should have had. And it's one of these catastrophes of history that we got the American dollar as the reserve currency in the first place. Having you know, said all that, I think that you'd be, as the Bancor itself was targeting, trying to keep the range of trade surpluses of no greater than and deficit of -2% to +2% of GDP was the sensible target.
Right, but no one's going to buy into that if they've got a trade surplus which is considerably more than that. So China's not going to want it, and the US isn't going to want to give away its reserve currency status. So
yeah, well, like in Germany was running a trade surplus at various times of 10% of GDP. The Netherlands is similar. Mm. Japan has been running a large trade surplus, and that's effectively giving them a cheap source of investment funds.
Yeah.
So then they were going to you know, argue against it. The loser out of this is the country that insisted on being the reserve currency in the first place, which is America.
Right. Okay. Well, we'll no doubt come back and visit that again. Look, that's it for today. Yeah, let's look at the contrarians, yourself included, Steve Keen. We'll look at that next week. Good to talk.
Okay.
And that's it for this week. I'm Phil Dobby, back with Steve again next week. Thanks for listening.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.